Thank you, everybody, for coming. This is session 275, titled Looking Back, Looking Forward, The Many Voices of Ordained Women. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We also hope you're taking time to purchase goods from vendors, including booksellers like Benchmark Books. Please support Mormon Studies by supporting our vendors. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework. After this session, many attendees are gathering at the local Crown Burger, a Utah tradition. Please return on time for our plenary with Dr. Gregory Prince. Seats will fill up quickly. All right, about this presentation. This year marks the fifth anniversary of the founding of Ordained Women. As the Ordained Women Executive Board, we are excited about what the future holds as we implement a new organizational structure that emphasizes both individual and collective local and global activism on women's ordination and gender equality in Mormonism. This panel will not only draw on the past to inform a discussion of our initiatives going forward, but will also feature the thoughts and experiences of a number of those who share the common vision of a Mormonism that better reflects the radical inclusiveness of Christ's message. All right, I'm going to introduce the panel. You probably know all of them, but I'll ask you to when I call your name, indicate by the raise of the right hand.
To the square. Got it.
All right. Lori Winder Stromberg serves on the Ordained Women Executive Board as chair of the Long-Term Planning Committee. April Young Bennett is a member of the Exponent 2 Board. Margaret Toscano is a professor at the University of Utah. Lori LeVar Pierce, has an MBA and teaches high school French, German, Latin, speech, and debate. She has a profile at Ordained Women since its inception and serves on a long-term strategy committee. Deborah Jensen is an assistant professor of communication at Utah State University and Ordained Women Executive Board member. Soon we will see Marina Capella. She is a pediatrician at North County Health Services. She'll be in shortly. And then Brindis Roberts is going to be joining us as a recording. And she is the chair of Ordained Women's Executive Board. All right. To you, Lori.
Thank you.
We did everything except turn the thing on.
Well, since the power's on, I don't know.
I'm not good with button pushing. Any good button pushing?
I got it. Hang on. I'll work. Lori, are you going first? Who's going first?
I am.
All right, you do that while I do this.
Okay.
I don't know. Since the power's on,
but I'm not
sure. Okay.
We're live.
And now I just had to look at it.
Okay, I have to get the first part of mine because she already read it. So, since OW, or Ordained Women, has always been collaborative, this panel not only will draw on the past to inform a discussion of our initiatives going forward, but also feature the thoughts and experiences of a number of Ordained Women executive board members and supporters who share the common vision of a more equitable Mormonism. The order of our prepared remarks will proceed as follows. I'll give a brief introduction and personal statement, after which Margaret Toscano will place Ordained Women and the movement for women's ordination in Mormonism in historical context. Then Brindis Roberts, in a recorded message as OW's executive board chair, will offer personal reflections and talk about coming changes in our organizational structure. Brindis will be followed by Marina Capella, then Lori LeVar Pierce, then April Young Bennett, and Deborah Jensen will follow. Their presentations will be interspersed with brief statements from Ordained Women board members, most of whom could not be here. They will be read by friends in the audience. Hopefully, we'll have enough time at the end for questions and comments. Throughout the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, independent LDS forums and publications such as Dialogue Sunstone, the Sunstone Symposia, Exponent 2, and the Mormon Women's Forum provided invaluable, though by their very nature limited, public platforms for the discussion of Mormon feminist issues. However, the internet was a game changer in terms of its ability to reach a much broader audience and facilitate feminist activism through online organizing, discussion lists, blogs, and websites. Many believed its reach and transparency would protect Mormon feminists from the excommunications and institutional retaliations of the past that tended to dampen feminist activism and led Salt Lake Tribune religion writer Peggy Fletcher Stack to ask in 2003, "Where have all the Mormon feminists gone?" What Stack overlooked in her article was that Mormon feminism was establishing itself online. The process, however, was not seamless, nor would the internet's scope prove to be universally effective in uniting the Mormon feminist community or protecting individual feminists from institutional reprisal. A significant split in the Mormon feminist community emerged between those who wanted more expansive opportunities for women in the church but stopped short of advocating for significant structural change, and those who called for full structural equality and were willing to risk institutional reprisal. Female ordination was the flashpoint. We officially launched Ordained Women on March 17, 2013. In an essay I wrote about its birth, I wrote, "For most of us, Ordained Women began with a simple acknowledgement. I'm a Mormon, and I believe women should be ordained." This realization came long ago for some and much more recently for others. It was a bold assertion in a patriarchal church where the lay priesthood and its attendant administrative and decision-making authority were seen as a divine power bestowed only on men in the faith, enabling them to preside over church and home. The theological and practical arguments that supported such an acknowledgement had been constructed by a handful of Mormon feminists over three decades, a few of whom are in this room. However, a significant social movement could not coalesce around the issue of women and priesthood ordination in Mormonism until a profound shift in attitudes and expectations about gender equality emerged, one sufficient enough to create a critical dissonance between Mormon women's lived experience and LDS cultural norms. Margaret has written about this. There also had to be an effective, far-reaching social platform to facilitate communication and collaboration among enough of those troubled by the dissonance that they, through an alchemy of personalities and social networks, were compelled to confront it. Sites like Feminist Mormon Housewives and Exponent 2 provided hospitable forums that facilitated that profound shift, even when many Mormon feminists were unconvinced or afraid to consider the question of women's ordination. They were also established platforms that helped us reach a receptive audience. When several of the well-respected Exponent bloggers responded positively to my email soliciting some of the first ordained women, "I'm a Mormon, and I believe women should be ordained" profiles, OW gained immediate credibility in the Mormon feminist community. Further, the bold sincerity of the initial profiles uploaded to our website, which now numbered nearly 700, combined with a reasonable, Mormon-friendly website, a carefully crafted message that had been honed in the fall of 2012 in the FAQ "At All Are Likened to God," and a commitment to activism proved to be more compelling than even we expected. Word of Ordained Women spread rapidly through the Mormon blogs. The website received nearly 10,000 discreet hits in its initial 24 hours. At our first in-person action the following October, nearly 200 women and men walked with us to Temple Square to ask for admittance to the priesthood session of General Conference. As expected, we were turned away, one by one, at the doors of the tabernacle. We wore our Sunday best and waited reverently in line while men and boys, barely out of grade school, were ushered past us into the session. The images were poignant. They, of course, went viral. Over the past 40 years, my feminism has always been activist, and much of it has been devoted to advocating for women's ordination in the LDS Church. I remain concerned about how gender inequality negatively impacts all of us, and convinced that the fundamental inequality of an all-male priesthood within Mormonism is such that anything less than ordination for women is insufficient. Two, an exclusive priesthood policy seems at odds with what I understand to be foundational to Mormonism itself, namely, the expansive belief that God does not hoard power as if it were in short supply or reserve it for an elite few, but shares it liberally and makes it available to all. I still believe Mormonism, at its best, can help liberate rather than subjugate women and other marginalized groups. However, it must be held accountable when it does not. I see ordained women as continuing to do just that until the church fully reflects the radical inclusiveness of Christ's message. Inequality cannot go unchallenged. And as Mormons, we are called to a moral activism that holds us responsible for our choice either to perpetuate inequality through silence and inaction or to work vigorously for justice and equality.
We're trying to avoid having the light shine in our eyes, which is why we've all moved to this corner. So let's see if I can speak in the mic and also...
There's so much room over here.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah. That's a good idea.
I'll join Deborah.
Hell yeah, you will. Oh, sorry. Heck yeah, you will.
And hide behind the... I'm going to stand up here. I know. I will go there. Hello. Mormon women have a stronger theological and historical claim to priesthood than do women of any other Christian denomination. Nevertheless, from the death of Joseph Smith, Mormon male priesthood leaders have systematically opposed, punished, and silenced women who have publicly asserted that claim. In this short presentation, I wish to forefront just a few key events in church history that demonstrate how LDS leaders have covered up or disinformed Mormon women regarding their right to priesthood. As a Mesa, Arizona girl growing up in the LDS Church, I accepted what I was taught, namely that men have priesthood and women have motherhood, which struck me as an unfair arrangement even then. In the 1970s, as a student at BYU, I began to question this assertion and commenced my research of the underlying theological and historical bases for it. What I learned was that Joseph Smith had promised the women of the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo all of the rights, privileges, keys, and blessings of the priesthood, and also that he had actually ordained or instructed women to be ordained to the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood in 1843 and 1844. While I was engaged in my research, I received my own temple endowments. The combination of my spiritual experiences in the temple, together with the historical information I was gathering, led me to believe and feel deeply that I had received priesthood through my endowment. Notwithstanding this belief, I was still not certain how the temple priesthood related to the priesthood to which men ordained in the church. In the 1970s, Joseph Smith's speeches to the Nauvoo Relief Society were not readily available. When I finally read his original language, I was shocked at the directness and clarity with which he promised priesthood to women. I realized that the historical record had been doctored. His statement that he intended to make the Relief Society a kingdom of priests, as in Enoch's day and in Paul's day, had been changed to later to support later church leaders' denial of priesthood to women. I also learned that Joseph not only promised priesthood to women, but that he acted to fulfill that promise. The documentary evidence shows that Emma Smith was anointed and ordained to the highest and holiest order of the priesthood on September 28, 1843. The exact language of that ordination makes Emma Smith historically the Elijah Abel for women's right to priesthood ordination. Thank you. Other women were likewise ordained in that same period. Later church leaders have obscured Joseph's promises and have asserted, now that we see the records, that these ordinations of women are not equivalent to the ordinations of men in the church, but are merely about marriage sealings and celestial partnerships. Joseph Smith's clear statements to the women contradict these assertions, and his last discourses to the church demonstrate that he believed that the fullness of the temple priesthood embraced all the other orders of priesthood that had been revealed to the church at large, and that the church priesthood was not complete nor fully restored without the women participating. I accept Joseph's view. Notwithstanding, I believe with ordained women that LDS women cannot be content with the temple priesthood alone, but women must be ordained both to priesthood and church offices just as men are. I do not believe that the LDS church can be right before God until women sit in the councils of the church, the first presidency, the quorum of the 12, stake presidencies, bishoprics, and so forth. Through my research, I also became aware that after Joseph's death, LDS church leaders from Brigham Young to the present have made various attempts to bury Joseph's expanded view of priesthood and his ordinations of women. The most important and depressing of these attempts occurred in the 30-year period between 1892 and 1922. What happened was this, in kind of a shortened version. On March 17, 1892, at the 50-year celebration of the organization of the Relief Society, Sarah M. Kimball read this statement. President Joseph Smith stated that the meeting in Nauvoo was called for the purpose of making more complete the organization of the church by organizing the women in the order of the priesthood. Relief Society President Bathsheba W. Smith, who had also been present at the Nauvoo Relief Society organization and was a member of the Anointed Quorum, made a number of clarifying statements on this issue. For example, in 1901, she said, "We have not taken these responsibilities upon ourselves, but have been called in the order of the Holy Priesthood." In 1905, she boldly stated, "Joseph said he wanted to make us, as the women were in Paul's day, a kingdom of priestesses. We have the ceremony in our endowments, as Joseph taught." Later, she declared emphatically, "Joseph gave us women everything, every order of the priesthood, and instructions that we could administer to the sick." Such strong statements were printed in the official women's publication, Woman's Exponent. Following this, in 1906, the male church leaders responded to these claims by pressuring the women into retracting their statements and asserting instead that the Relief Society had never been intended to be a priesthood organization, but rather had always been intended to serve under the direction of male priesthood leaders. Then between 1907 and 1922, top church leaders made one official statement after another denying that women ever had any claim to any portion of the priesthood whatsoever, thus contradicting the testimonies of Bathsheba Smith, Sarah Kimball, and other women who had direct knowledge and experience of actually being ordained to the highest and holiest order of priesthood under the direction of Joseph Smith himself. For the next 60 years, the idea that women had a right to priesthood lay dormant until reasserted by scholars like me, my husband Paul, and Michael Quinn. It is no accident that all three of us were excommunicated for these and other assertions starting 25 years ago. Supporting women's ordination, priesthood ordination, was not the main reason given for either Mike or Paul's excommunication, but importantly, it was the crucial issue for me, the woman. Leaders told me they needed to excommunicate me so that people wouldn't believe what I said about priesthood. In 2012, the speeches of Joseph Smith to the Nauvoo Relief Society became available online. This information reinforced the belief of some church members that Mormon women should be ordained to priesthood. Others had become convinced of the rightness of this position by their own spiritual feelings or their commitment to equality in the church. Although many women began to harbor this view from the 1970s onward, their sub rosa feelings were brought to the surface by the appearance in 2013 of Ordained Women, which provided a forum and support group for the public declaration of the belief that Mormon women should be ordained to priesthood. The importance of group solidarity for encouraging public declarations cannot be overstated. Kate Kelly's excommunication in June of 2014 sent a clear message to church members that they would be opposed, punished, and silenced by church leaders for asserting women's claim to priesthood. Kate became the prime public example, though others have paid the price too. Although these punitive actions are consonant with those perpetrated in the past, it is heartening that this has not prevented individuals from declaring their belief in women's ordination. There is power in group solidarity. Profiles and testimonies continue to be posted on ordainedwomen.org. I applaud individuals who are speaking out, but still ecclesiastical silencing and punishment have chilled the movement, caused people to resign their membership in the church, and continue to thwart women's full participation in church governance. I am glad Ordained Women has remained a public presence, though it appears that the impetus and energy to have a large protest movement advocating women's ordination to priesthood has sadly diminished. I think this is actually natural. If you look at the history of movements, you can't always maintain, you know, a really intense. You have to have the cycles of kind of attack and then withdraw. So I'm not criticizing. I think that it's actually, it always happens in these groups and is fine, as long as you don't give up. Still, even as a symbolic presence, Ordained Women is a vital organization. The power of patriarchal thinking and its concomitant prejudice against women's ordination will, I fear, continue into the future, where I believe it is likely that gay marriage will be solemnized in the temple before Joseph Smith's promise of priesthood to women will be fulfilled. I hope both happen in my lifetime, right? I'm in favor of both, right? But if they don't, I believe the Spirit of God will continue to work with his people until a greater equality is achieved for all, black and white, gay and straight, male and female. The scriptures stand as the standard for the church, and they admonish us again and again to reflect Christ's love by how we treat each other. We are Christ's so long as we do the work of Christ, which is to empower the powerless and to relieve the pain of any who suffer. Thank you.
Everybody, Brenda sent this to me today. She wanted to make sure that you knew she sent it 28 minutes before it was due. She was really proud of that. So I'm gonna play it on my phone into this microphone, and it will be fun.
Good evening. First, let me thank you for coming to the Ordained Women session. Second, let me express my apologies for not being able to be with you in person. Please know that I would much prefer to be there with you. I want to begin my talk with these words from L.R. Nost. And just when the darkness became too much to bear and the struggle too hard, the light broke through and the caterpillar emerged, a butterfly. delicate but unbroken, wild and gentle, finally free to spread its lovely wings and fly away on the wind. Earlier this year, we celebrated the 5th anniversary of the founding of Ordained Women. In the lead up to that celebration, the Executive Board of Ordained Women spent a lot of time in thought and prayer about Ordained Women, our past, our present, and our future.
I don't know what just happened. Hold, please. It went to sleep. I know what happened. Stop. Why are you like this?
Many of us had experienced when Ordained Women was launched, or when Ordained Women held the first and second priesthood actions, had been followed by a period of darkness and sorrow, filled with excommunications, exclusionary policies, and talk of counterfeit relationships. Our commitment to the struggle for equality in faith was tested even more by the pain and sorrow of our siblings who bravely stepped forward and said, #MeToo, as they shared their heart-wrenching stories of sexual abuse at the hands of church leaders. It has been a long and difficult road, and the woods that separate us from attaining equality in faith, while indeed dark and deep, have not been lovely. Yet, we have persevered as an organization and as individuals. We believe that while we have not yet attained the full victory, we have emerged from the struggle with renewed strength and determination. As chair of the Executive Board of Ordained Women, I would like to share with you two things. One relates to my individual journey on this quest for equality in faith. The other relates to the collective journey of Ordained Women. With respect to my individual journey, I would like to share a portion of a letter that I wrote to the First Presidency as part of the celebration of the 5th anniversary of Ordained Women. As a 60-year-old black woman who grew up in South Georgia and who has lived in Georgia all my life, I have experienced far too many instances of being treated as a second-class citizen and being denied the opportunity to utilize all of my skills, talents, and gifts simply because I am a black woman. The pain of those experiences has affected and continues to affect every part of my life. Our scriptures teach us that all are alike unto God. And in the faith of those teachings, I find it difficult to accept or reconcile when my sisters and I are treated as less important than our brothers or denied the opportunity to fully participate in the work of building up the kingdom simply because we are women. There is so much work to be done. Just imagine how much more productive and fruitful our efforts would be if all of the children of our heavenly parents, female and male, were allowed to function as full and equal partners in the work. I have spent many hours in prayer on this subject, and I do not believe that it is the divine will that simply by virtue of our gender, all women are limited in the roles we can fulfill in the church, and ultimately in the roles we can fulfill in building the kingdom. As important as the work is, I cannot believe that it is the divine will that so many workers are not allowed to participate fully and equally. My prayer that women be ordained does not arise from any desire for prestige or recognition or from any envy of the men in the church. I rejoice every time one of my brothers is ordained as a priest. However, I also ache for all women in the church and for the church. I ache because my wonderful, talented sisters have skills, training, and experience that could greatly benefit the church. I ache because in many parts of the world, there are wards and branches that are in desperate need of more leaders and more priesthood holders. And by automatically excluding women from consideration, the church is doing itself a disservice. I ache because so much kingdom building work is not being done because there are not enough priesthood holders to do the work. In 2014, those feelings and those experiences propelled me to stand with other courageous women and men and voice my prayer, my desire, my wish for women's ordination in the church. There have been a number of changes since I initially expressed my prayer that women in the church should be ordained. Some of those changes, being released from my calling and being deprived from my temple recommend, have sorely tested my relationship with the LDS Church as an institution. However, my belief in the LDS Church as part of the body of Christ and my commitment to my baptismal covenants remain unchanged, as does my belief in the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ and in the teachings that all are alike unto God. As a beloved daughter of our heavenly parents and as your sister, those beliefs propel me to come to you in your ordained roles as prophets, seers, and revelators, and to express my fervent prayer, abiding hope, and sincere wish that women in the LDS Church be ordained. With respect to the journey of ordained women, I would like to share our vision of a new organizational structure. In response to the changing needs and wishes of those who support and/or are part of the Ordained Women movement, the board has decided to expand the reach of Ordained Women by providing for the establishment of a community-based network of local affiliates. We believe this new structure will help propel us into being a truly worldwide movement and allow more space for local autonomy and creativity. Local affiliates will have the opportunity to plan and execute actions that best reflect the values and concerns within their community. Affiliates will be asked to commit to honoring the values and mission of Ordained Women, engaging in faith-affirming strategic action, and foregoing unauthorized or rogue ordinations. This commitment will be made through a registration process, which will provide access to the use of the Ordained Women name and logo. As we continue to strive for equality in the church, we hope that this structural change will more fully reflect Ordained Women's commitment to intersectionality and faith-affirming strategic action. Our struggle is not over, brothers and sisters, but we come to you as the members of the Ordained Women Executive Board with renewed strength and determination, asking you to continue to walk with us and to work with us as we seek to attain equality in faith. Thank you.
My name is Laura Pennock, and I am the newest member of the Ordained Women Executive Committee. When I told people about my appointment, I was almost immediately asked, "Why do you continue to engage with Ordained Women?" It's a legitimate question. I'm no longer attending an LDS ward. I have joined Community of Christ. I think most of us have moved beyond active engagement with the LDS Church. Maybe we no longer even identify as LDS. Perhaps we have had our names removed or have, like me, joined another church. Here's my answer. Their misogyny, their homophobia, their racism do not remain confined to the walls of their chapels. These things poison the entire community. This is my community. I live here. I work here. I have family here. There is a reason Utah is at the top of the list of worst states for women. There is a reason teen suicide rates in Utah is staggering. Whose influence drove the declaration of pornography as a public health emergency rather than, say, air quality? It was a Sunday morning that I got a text message from Brindis, the chair of Ordained Women who we have just heard from, saying she wanted to talk to me. I knew what was on her mind. I just knew. So I was thinking about it during the service that day. I had been burning with anger and outrage at the LDS Church for a long time, and the latest big, fat deal, the Joseph Bishop debacle, that exposed the systemic nature of abuse and cover-up in the church had just exploded all over my Facebook page. My anger and my outrage were righteous and appropriate, and they still are there. But everything was suddenly different. As I sat there contemplating the thought that Brindis was going to ask me if I would be willing to join the board of ordained women and meditating on what that would look like, my heart turned in a different direction. Grace infused my feelings. Rather than wanting to loose a wildfire on the institution and its leaders for the sole purpose of burning it down and walking away, I still want to burn it down, but only in order to give them opportunity to create something new. Let me share with you some phrases from Section 162 of the Community of Christ Doctrine and Covenants, which I believe speak to the Brighamites as urgently as they speak to the Josephites. Listen carefully to your own journey as a people, for it is a sacred journey, and it has taught you many things you must know for the journey yet to come. Listen to its teachings and discover anew its principles. Do not yearn for times that are past, but recognize that you have been given a foundation of faithful service, even as you build a foundation for what is yet to be. You are called to discern the divine will for your own time and in the places where you serve. You live in a world with new challenges, and that will require new forms of ministry. Be respectful of tradition and sensitive to one another, but do not be unduly bound by interpretations and procedures that no longer fit the needs of a worldwide church. The spirit of the restoration is not locked in one moment of time, but is instead the call to every generation to witness to essential truths in its own language and forms. Let the spirit breathe. I believe that is the purpose for which ordained women was called into being. We are making a difference. I regularly hear accounts of encounters with local leaders who are trying to be more inclusive, of discussions in ward meetings that include topics never before spoken aloud, of individuals speaking up against harmful rhetoric and challenging longstanding cultural norms, of women and men consciously observing their daughters being treated very differently than their sons. Recently, LDS Living published an article entitled, "You Are My People, Inactive Gay Mormon Shares Powerful Insights After Attending Church for the First Time in Years." I wasn't sure what I would find, considering the source, but from that article, imagine my surprise then to get a Facebook message from my friend saying the bishop and his wife in her mom's ward in Riverton, Utah, had organized a meeting for and about the needs of LGBTQ Latter-day Saints. They had invited their entire ward to attend. They were unsure how many would come, but they wanted her to tell all her LGBTQ friends that they were welcome there. A few paragraphs later, I could see almost every color, shape, size, race, ethnicity, orientation, and identity you could imagine, clothed in the most vibrant, creative attire, seated alongside ward members, family members, and allies, eager to make space among the makeshift pews of metal folding chairs for their LGBTQ brothers and sisters. I don't think I've ever seen anything more beautiful. What if it could be like this, the author thought. What if this weren't just a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence? What if you could expect to see this walking into every LDS meeting around the world on any given Sunday? While LDS Living is not an official publication of the church, you can be sure that it exists only because the church hasn't killed it. But it is being read by active, devout LDS people. What if? As I sat in the Sunday service contemplating Brenda's text and half listening to a wonderful sermon that I do not remember, I suddenly imagined a holy fire sweeping through the church office building that cleansed away what no longer serves any purpose in order to make room for new growth, new ways of being. Imagine an LDS church committed to mustering its legions and its resources to make a sincere, sustained, and ongoing effort to be who they claim to be. It would transform this community, this region, this state, the world. It takes my breath away. May it be so.
Hi, my name is Marina. I've been an active but somewhat subdued supporter of ordained women since April of 2013. For me, joining this movement was a no-brainer. I became an ardent feminist in college, hastened along by a progressive university environment at Stanford, and in no small part by my feminist husband, who I met in college, and his parents, Levina Fielding and Paula Anderson. I'd already had to wade through the cognitive dissonance created by my desire to pursue a career in medicine, and had ultimately chosen to reject complementarian gender theology. In my professional life, I learned, trained, and worked alongside my male peers, and was entrusted with just as many responsibilities as them. At the time Ordained Women was started, I was in the last year of my residency training and had become confident in my professional abilities. The co-ed work experience and the confidence I had developed in my own abilities helped me further recognize how ludicrous the LDS Church's views on gender differences and gender quote-unquote equality really were. Christian and I participated in the October 2013 priesthood session action and gained a little bit of optimism from the level of participation we witnessed and the conversations that reverberated throughout the Mormon world afterward. The following year, our optimism took a dive after the excommunication of Kate Kelly. Excommunication, however, wasn't new to the Anderson family. Christian had chosen to remain active in church even after his own mother's excommunication in 1993. While Kate's excommunication was shocking and heartbreaking, it wasn't enough to push us out. We had, after all, an incredible example of stalwart, stubborn persistence in Levina. In 2015, I was feeling more despondent in a new ward that seemed hostile to heterodoxy. I wondered if my mere membership made me somehow complicit in the church's wrongs and considered resigning. My despondency peaked in March of 2015 when I had a disheartening experience at church. In an atypical act of bravery, I decided to write and share a genuine testimony one fast Sunday. I intentionally waited to be the last speaker, anticipating that my remarks might spark some backlash by my bishopric. I opened by sharing some benign remarks about how fast and testimony meeting gives us an opportunity to share genuine experiences and come to see one another as more than nicely dressed automatons devoid of personal struggles. Then I got to the doozy. These were my remarks that followed. I have been considering resigning my membership from this church. After 32 years as a member, this is not an easy thing to consider. It is a painful prospect. But the fact is, I don't feel like there is an acceptable place for me in this church anymore. I don't believe some of the things I once did, nor do I think I ever can. Specifically, I don't believe that the gendered segregation of leadership and priesthood responsibilities in this church is doctrine inspired by God. I think that gender, like race, is one of the many differences among us that conspires to divide us rather than unite us. Somewhere in the middle of that last sentence, with a few paragraphs left to go, a woman in the back of the chapel stood up and loudly proclaimed, "You need to stop." I paused my testimony, turned to the bishop, and asked him if I needed to stop. He looked like a deer in the headlights. So I decided I would probably stop to avoid further drama. I turned back to the audience, and the woman in the back again loudly proclaimed, "You need to stop." I looked at her and, still teary-eyed and blubbering a little, replied, "We are called to mourn with those that mourn and comfort those that stand in need of comfort. How dare you call yourself a Christian?" And left the podium. The bishop abruptly brought the meeting to a close, and his counselor bore a quick but firm, "The church is true" testimony to end the meeting. A host of people came up to me afterwards, gave me hugs, and apologized for what had happened. My bishop called me later that day to apologize as well, but also made it clear that I could not discuss such topics at church without risking church discipline. The woman who had commanded me to stop later wrote me a note that explained she did what she did to, quote, protect the children, ironically enough. We stuck it out in that ward a few more months before deciding we needed a break. We attended another church for about 6 months, but something nagged us to return. We eventually found ourselves attending a Spanish-speaking ward where I was abruptly and very unexpectedly called to be Young Women's president. I was open with my bishop about my viewpoints and struggles, but he insisted that the inspiration he had received to call me to the position was undeniable, and it warranted defending the call to the stake presidency despite their reservations. I have appreciated his faith in Revelation and in me as I've done my best to serve the young women of our small and struggling ward. My service the past 2 years has required some sacrifice and discomfort. I was pressured to renew my temple recommend. I have to grit my teeth through comments in church meetings and avoid discussing certain topics openly and honestly. I can only hope I have done some good teaching what I can in my own nuanced ways and leading by example. Christian and I will be moving to Utah in a few months, so the next chapter of our religious life remains to be written. To be honest, we're hoping for another break to recharge. Reflecting on my own experience and the experiences of other supporters, I have two parting thoughts. First, being a supporter of women's ordination within the LDS church often comes at severe personal costs. Church discipline, family estrangement, and blowback from ward members, even in progressive wards, are all too common. For any woman who chooses to stay, the constant reminder that she is not allowed to fully exercise her spiritual gifts can be equally painful. Second, ordained women encourages critical thinking to garner support. However, if successful, supporters often begin to think critically about other issues, LGBTQ mistreatment, race relations, historical deceptions, authoritarianism, colonialism, etc. Once you realize there's more than just one big problem to solve, long-term activity in the church and ordained women becomes less and less tenable. For many ordained women supporters, the church's response to ordained women, especially Kate's excommunication, and later the November exclusion policy, functioned to highlight other big problems of ecclesiastical abuse and mistreatment of LGBT individuals. As a result, many supporters stepped away from church activity and hand in hand ordained women activism. To move forward, we may well have to embrace the fact that ordained women will often be a stepping stone on a longer faith journey for all but the most self-sacrificing and dedicated among us. Lori, I'm looking at you. Is it worth it then? I think it is. I think that trying to make the world a more equitable place for ourselves and future generations is worthwhile. Very few of us may be in it for the long haul, but lots of small efforts by many people add up to something greater, and that's how progress happens.
My name is Vicki Eastman, and I am reading this statement for and in behalf of Christy Ellis Clegg, who is not dead, and has written her statement. There she is. What a lovely woman. She writes, "Since ordained women's founding 5 years ago, there have been changes within the church directly as the result of ordained women's work. One of the contributions this movement has made to Mormonism has been in bringing the idea and conversation about women's ordination to the priesthood out into the open among church members. Whether or not one is wondering about women's ordination, supportive of women's ordination, or deeply opposed to women's ordination, the question is being discussed and debated among church members today. Importantly, These conversations are not just happening among progressive Mormons in private or behind closed doors, but rather some of these conversations are happening within the walls of our meeting houses. I submitted my profile in May of 2013, shortly after the founding of Ordain Women. I decided to submit a profile and participate in Ordain Women actions because I fiercely believed that if we had the opportunity to access our leaders and communicate to them our experiences in the current structure of the church and the reasons that led us to the idea of women's ordination, I believed our leaders would hear us, respond to us, and see us as Christ does, seekers of truth. I didn't expect that women would immediately be ordained, or that these ideas would be immediately welcomed. I also didn't expect the negative treatment supporters of ordained women received from church leadership and from other members of the church. Rather than being treated as committed members of the church who wanted to more fully participate, we were treated as enemies who wanted to harm the church. This experience was a turning point in my life and in my spiritual development within the church. I had to grapple with the knowledge that my deeply held values are not shared by the church leadership, and instead, these values are discouraged and punished. This realization about my faith eventually led me away from regularly attending church. Let me just stop here for a moment and turn back into Vicki Eastman. What Christy has written here is exactly the experience that I had. I went into this so impressed with the leaders of this movement, with their respect, with their capability, and I was deeply, deeply distressed at the attacks that came upon them after months and months of trying to open a dialogue, which was not even recognized, and then the attacks that occurred. I too have stepped away from active attendance at church. So Christy and I are literally on the same page. Back to Christy. At times I have wondered or been asked about why I continue to stay engaged with a group advocating for women's ordination to the priesthood when I no longer attend church and would not opt to be ordained today, even if it were revealed that women could be ordained. One reason that I continue to stay engaged in advocating for women's ordination is because I have recognized and experienced the harm that is caused when women are taught that they have a separate but equal role, and especially because that separate role excludes women from having spiritual and institutional authority. These rigid views of men's and women's roles and capabilities didn't just impact me during church activities. These views also impacted the decisions I made outside of the church, how I viewed myself in the world, and they became interwoven with my identity. My hope is that there will be, in future generations, women in the church who will never know through experience the challenges and pains of existing within a structure that tells women they are separate but equal and have no institutional or spiritual authority. A few months ago, I attended a panel discussion in New York City about religious feminism. One of the panelists, Mona El-Tahawi, spoke about her own religious activism in the Muslim faith. Though she is not currently a believer and describes herself as a liberal Muslim, she continues to speak about and advocate for equality in the Muslim faith. Mona highlighted her reasons for continuing that work by using an example of transgendered individuals serving in the military. Mona stated that while she is not transgendered and has not served in the military, she believes that transgendered individuals should be able to serve in the military. It is simply an issue of equality that impacts our world and represents the values we hold. Hearing Mona share her thinking on this made a lot of sense to me. Whether or not I attend church on a weekly basis doesn't determine the validity of my involvement. Engaging in a cause to highlight inequality and wanting to help correct it is valid. It is also a cause that is personal for me. I am a Mormon and have invested in the church and have experienced the effects of the current structure. My hope for ordained women in the coming years is that the organization will continue to bring attention to the issues of inequality in the church. My hope is also that ordained women will continue to engage in direct actions that keep the conversation going. My hope is that these conversations will expose future generations of young men and young women to critically thinking about women in expanded roles.
Four days before I graduated from primary and moved into the Young Women's Organization, there was a tectonic shift in the LDS Church when the priesthood was once again ordained to black men. As a child living in Arkansas, I didn't know any black members of the church, and I was unaware of the wider social calls for change or any of the nuanced differences between that and women's ordination. All I knew was that something major had changed within the LDS Church. Having lived my entire life in the U.S. South at that point and being part of a Southern family whose roots literally go all the way back to Jamestown, I was well aware of the social attitudes towards blacks and whites and had been taught all of the doctrinal arguments that favored denying priesthood and temple blessings to black members. And then it changed. My dad was the first branch president for a small branch in my hometown that was created when I was 10. I watched him on some Sundays conduct the sacrament meeting, say both the opening and the closing prayer, and bless and pass the sacrament. He was often the only priesthood holder in the room. I looked forward to helping him on some of those responsibilities. At the age of 11, he handed me a hymn book and said, "Teach yourself to lead the hymns because we need a chorister for sacrament meeting." As we discussed ordination for women, because it was a question for me as I had watched that change, it became an issue for me, and I wondered what would happen with women. My dad always told me that the scriptural justifications for denying women the priesthood were just as flimsy as the ones had been for denying it for black men all those years. And now, those rationales, once taught as doctrine, that I learned in church, have been disavowed as incorrect speculation. Even if you have to look a little deeply in LDS in order to find that, it is there. So I had hope. I had lots of hope. But I also knew the reality was that it wasn't likely to happen very quickly. So I pushed it to the back of my mind, or put it on my shelf, as we often say, and I went on with my life and found other things to focus on. Sometimes I prayed that it would happen more quickly, and sometimes I was able to find a like-minded person to discuss it with, but mostly I just waited. And then ordained women came along. My profile was one of the very early ones on the site, and planning for the October 2013 priesthood session was underway. Now again, going back to my Southern roots, as a white Southerner, I didn't have a lot of positive ideas about protesters, and I didn't want to be one. But this action felt different to me, and I felt drawn to that event. Eventually, I bought a ticket to fly from Columbus, Mississippi to Salt Lake City just for 24 hours to attend that priesthood session, or not attend, try to attend the priesthood session of conference. I remember sitting on the plane with the gentleman who had actually helped build the tabernacle, or build the conference center, had done much of the woodwork, and he asked me what I was going to Salt Lake for. And I said I was going to attend conference. And he said, "Oh, do you have a ticket?" "No, actually I don't." And then at the end of the flight, I was able to explain to him, after we spent 4 hours talking the entire flight, I was able to explain to him what my real purpose was in going, and he wished me well and hoped that it would turn out for the best, which of course it didn't, but it gave me hope. That flying alone that distance to meet a group of people that I didn't know — Lori was just about the only one there that I'd ever met in person before I showed up in Salt Lake — though terrifying before I got on the plane, was one of the most spiritual experiences of my life, as it was for many of the women who participated that day in October 2013. So then, I was in a Relief Society presidency at that point, and 2 days before I was about to get on the plane, I felt like I was in a presidency meeting and felt that I needed to share with them what I was planning to do. They listened. They didn't understand my reasons. They didn't agree with them, but they listened to me. Then on my way out of the building, my bishop stopped me And as my heart skipped a beat, he explained that he had read the post that I had put on Facebook. He knew that I was going to Salt Lake. He wished me well, and he hoped that change could happen. Later, his attitude changed as he listened to the church PR accounts rather than my first-person accounts of what had occurred in Salt Lake City. But he was for that at the beginning. Now, since October of 2013, I have sometimes participated and sometimes stayed more in the background of ordained women. While I felt a strong spiritual calling to participate in what happened in 2013, I haven't always felt that same spiritual pull to come to Utah to participate in these actions here. Most of my advocacy happens on the personal level. I have lots and lots and lots of conversations with people about ordination. One close family friend, who was a temple president at the time, called me to repentance when he first heard that I had participated in ordained women, and told me my father would have been horrified, and he felt that since my father was no longer alive, that he needed to step in and make sure that I was back on the right path. After some exchanging of letters and some discussions in his office in the temple, the last word on ordination for women, he said, was, "You never know what might happen." So I saw an attitude change as we continued to have discussions, honest discussions about it. There's a quote from Brené Brown that says, "It's hard to hate people close up, move in." So that's what I've done. In my ward, in my family, with my church friends, I have moved closer to have these one-on-one discussions. I have discovered that usually in these in-person discussions, and sometimes even on Facebook, when there are discussion moments, when real discussion is happening, you can come to at least some kind of an agreement. Usually it comes down to most people that I talk to agree that women should be ordained, and that would be fabulous, but it's not up to me to ask for change. It wasn't very many years ago that I was reprimanded and had the bishopric come in and correct what I had taught in Relief Society, because I was talking about women who had given blessings of healing in the early Relief Society days of the church. When that information was not readily available to share with them of where I had learned about that. Well, now that information is on the Gospel Library app that you hold in your hand in the church, and it's there for everyone to read. So I have seen changes. More recently, I had an amazing discussion in Relief Society with my bishop's wife, the wife of a member of my state presidency, and my Relief Society president, as we discussed women giving blessings of healing, both blessings of faith and being ordained to the priesthood and giving blessings, where they all agreed that that is a good thing. But this is not to say that the road is easy or that everyone agrees with me. But I have found more agreement than disagreement overall as I have these one-on-one conversations. Since my ward includes an Air Force training base, we have a lot of turnover and a lot of women come in and out of my ward. I come in contact with them. Coincidence or not, any bishop who has started to give me a difficult time about my advocacy for women has found, through typically unforeseen and mostly unwelcome job circumstances, they are moving and I'm no longer my bishop. I have had 7 different bishops in 15 years in the same ward. So as a child and a youth, I was always the only Mormon in my school. My church leaders taught me that it was a good thing to be peculiar, that it didn't matter if I had beliefs that no one else shared. I was right, and it didn't matter if I stood alone. That same training serves me well as a member of ordained women inside the LDS church. My church taught me to stand up for what I believe, even if that belief goes against the crowd. And I believe that women should be ordained.
So I am reading for Leah Marie Pirkin Silverman. I remember the first time it really hit me that men and boys in the church had access to something I did not. I was about 12 or 13 years old, and I was in my young women's class. The lesson was about the priesthood, and the teacher was talking about the great responsibility that the apostles have, that they are special witnesses of the Lord. She hypothesized about whether the apostles meet the Savior in this life as a part of their special witness. And I thought, that would be so amazing. It would be so incredible to see and talk with the Savior and then spend your life testifying of him. And then, in the next heartbeat, I realized that could never be me. I would never be called to that. Not because I am not worthy or because I lack testimony, simply because I was born a girl. I was crushed. Over the years, I attempted to console myself by remembering the joy and responsibility of motherhood. I knew this was supposed to be the right answer, but however I tried, this consolation felt empty because I've always known the comparison isn't apt. Motherhood's true parallel is fatherhood. After I became a mother, I saw this made manifest in my husband, who is a wonderful, nurturing, compassionate father. I can't pretend anymore that I am content with the status quo because I am a mother. To be clear, this is not a complaint about my role as a mother, but my husband is both a father and a priesthood holder, and this magnifies his role as a husband, father, and servant of Christ. I just want the same. Having access to the power of God on earth would magnify my role as wife, mother, and servant of Christ.
Great. Yeah, we didn't plan out the tech in advance. Hi, I'm April Young Bennett, and I was one of the early organizers of Ordained Women, and I was asked to reflect back on some of the things that I learned with part of that experience. And so I wrote down a list, and I came up with Lucky 13. So I'm going to share with you 13 things I learned as one of the early organizers of Ordained Women. So let's do number one. All right, the only way to communicate with the brethren is through the media. When I served as an Ordained Women board member, I signed 5 different letters that board members sent to church headquarters requesting meetings with any general authority available or willing. We're talking 1 hour here, okay? 1 hour. They wouldn't give us that. And I learned later from a source at church headquarters that a general authority had instituted a silent treatment policy regarding Ordained Women, and they weren't allowed, no general authority was allowed to talk to us. So the way that we were able to communicate with the brethren was by talking to the media, and then the church would put out a PR statement and we could see what they thought about what we said. And sometimes if we were lucky, we'd even get a talk from someone like Elder Ballard or Elder Oaks. So that was how you talked to the brethren. Okay, number two. Oh, right. When Ordained Women first started, we were basically having meetings with each other 24/7. We were on Facebook, having Facebook conversations constantly, middle of the night. Lori doesn't sleep. I don't know if any of you know that about her. But we were talking all the time. Everyone had an idea for an action. We explored pretty much all of them. We implemented many of them. We were busy, busy, busy. And it was exciting, and it was exhausting, and there's no way anyone can do that their whole life, especially not for how long it's going to take before we actually ordain women. And so we learned that we've got to pace ourselves a little bit better than this if we're not going to burn out everyone. So this is a long-term project, and we need to think in a more long-term way of working because you can't do that forever. All right, number three. All right, the face of the movement should not be one face. In the very, very, very beginning, we made one strategic error in that we put a little bit too much airtime in front of one very wonderful and compelling member of the group, Kate Kelly. That put a target on her back, and it also created the wrong impression that it was one person's pet project instead of a movement with diverse support among Mormons. And we almost immediately recognized that that was an error and pivoted almost immediately, long before the first action. I became one of many spokespeople that we chose to represent us to the media so that it wasn't just one face out there, and already it was pretty much too late. Even now, people think that because Kate Kelly has moved on, that ordained women is no more, and it's not true. There's still a lot of us out there who still support this movement. And so, oops, I don't know. Let's look at number four. All right, a big ask makes incremental change more palatable. So in a church where even, say, a rebranding of the home teaching program is viewed as historic, in a church that conservative, if you ask for anything, they're like, we can't do that. Okay, so it was scary, you know, to ask for anything. So we asked for what we actually wanted, equality and priesthood. And we found that by asking for what we actually wanted, it put those little baby steps into perspective. And some of them happened. For example, since Ordained Women launched, there have been some really important changes to things that seemed permanent before then. For example, there was a long-term policy of firing women for having babies as Seminary Institute teachers. They don't do that anymore. Isn't that great? Yeah, I'm so pleased. Another thing, they added women to councils that at the general leadership level that had been men only forever. So, you know, make those baby steps possible by asking for what you really want. Let's move to number five. Taboos can be broken. Almost immediately upon launching Ordained Women, people were talking about whether women should have the priesthood. And I had already been involved in Mormon feminism for quite some time, and we weren't talking about that. We didn't dare to talk about that. Nobody was saying anything about it. And this made it possible for us to say it. And it wasn't only general members who changed the way they talked. It was even the brethren. You'll notice that since Ordained Women, the brethren are now talking about priesthood in a different way. They've adapted to the way the rest of us are talking about it. And you hear them talking about priesthood less as a form of masculinity and more as something that can be accessed by everyone through callings. It's not exactly what I want them to talk about, but it's a step in the right direction. Let's look at six. The internet doesn't protect us. I've got to confess. I don't know why I believed this. I was naive. But I really did believe, and many of us did, that the internet age was something totally different from what happened before, back when they used to, say, burn women at the stake or excommunicate Mormon feminists. So we thought that now things are different because, you know, there's so many of us talking, and we're all publishing everywhere instantly, and there's no way they could track everyone down and excommunicate everyone. And also, we thought the church wouldn't want that kind of bad PR, right? We were wrong. So the church doesn't need to track everyone down and punish everyone in order to stop a movement, or at least to, you know, give it a really bad shot. They only need to choose one or two big important faces, and they can scare everyone else into submission. And that bad PR that we thought they would want to avoid, I've since realized that the church doesn't necessarily use the media to bring the gospel to the whole world. That's a talking point they have, but I think really they're targeting a certain socially conservative segment of the population. As such, punishing people publicly and getting a lot of bad PR for it is kind of helpful for that purpose. So let's look at number seven. Obeying the rules doesn't protect us. Darn it. At the beginning, we thought that if we just followed the rules, and even though we were expressing unorthodox opinions, but we weren't breaking any of the church rules, we thought we would be okay and safe from discipline. That's not true at all. It's actually in the books that the church gives local lay leaders the privilege of punishing people for not following their counsel. Did you just hear that? Somebody can give you advice, and if you don't follow their advice, they can punish you. And it's in the books. So obeying the rules doesn't necessarily help. You don't have to break a written rule. Let's look at eight. Women are more expendable to the church than men. At the beginning, very few people experienced problems with their ecclesiastical leaders. But although we had both male and female supporters, we found that the supporters that were more likely to have a problem with their local priesthood holders were the women. And let's think about why that might be. If you punish a man, what do you risk? You risk losing a priesthood holder, and they need those, right? If you punish a woman, you know, we didn't really need her anyway. I think there's also a problem with the men who are priesthood holders. They understand other men, and they expect things from other men. They don't expect women to be so bold as to act in these bad ways or whatever, but they... So they're more shocked when they see a woman doing something that a man might do, a man like themselves, and that wouldn't bother them. So that's part of it. And then when you actually look at church policy, this expendability is actually written into church policy. When it comes to formal discipline, it's much easier to excommunicate a woman than it is to excommunicate a man. Let's look at 9. Censorship backfires. There was one point where my own stake president tried to silence my voice by forcing me to censor a bunch of blog posts using my brother's temple wedding as leverage. It was terrible, but hey, it was a long time ago and I feel better now. So I can talk about it. So at this time he did that, and what happened? Well, it drove so many views to the website where I blog, the Exponent 2, that the site crashed. And after the site crashed, it got in the media, it made national news. People found those blog posts, which, by the way, nobody was reading anymore. They were old blog posts. And on the internet, blog posts are, you know, dead after 3 days. So people looked up those old blog posts on internet archives and started sharing them. They probably got a lot more views because I deleted them than they would have otherwise. Let's look at 10. All right, formal recruitment efforts aren't necessary. This is kind of ironic because one of the reasons that Kate Kelly's bishop gave for excommunicating her was because of her recruitment efforts. We weren't recruiting and we didn't need to. It really wasn't necessary. One thing that I found is a common myth among church leaders is they believe that feminism is something that spreads from one woman to another like a contagion. And so thinking that's how it happens, they think that the obvious way to stop this is to find the vector and just kill it. But that is not how feminism spreads, in my opinion, or in my experience. The need for equality is innate. It springs up almost out of nowhere. I didn't know any Mormon feminists when I became one. And I found that that's true of many other people as well. Whenever we got any publicity at all for ordained women, whether it was good or bad, we had an influx of new supporters. And these people weren't people who were persuaded by anything we said or anything we did. These were people who already believed in equality, already believed women should be ordained, and they were just waiting to raise their voices until they met somebody else who agreed with them. So we didn't actually have to recruit. Let's look at 11, except for in one case. All right, so diversity requires effort. When you're doing a Mormon movement, the lowest hanging fruit is people like me. White people, middle class, living in a Mormon dense area of the Intermountain West who have, you know, I don't know, 20,000 generations of Mormons behind them. So if you want people like me, you don't have to recruit. We're everywhere. But if you want to have a more diverse effort where you're doing a more global effort, you're informed by more diverse voices, you actually have to seek out and work to attract those kinds of people, and you have to adapt your organization. And if the organization hadn't have adapted, we still would have been homogenous today. Let's look at 12. All right, for most Mormon feminism, activism is a short-term gig. I'm an exception. I've been here for a while. Lori's even more so of an exception. She's been here longer. but for most people, just being a woman and being Mormon and dealing with the patriarchy is exhausting, and many women can't do that for very long. Now, if you add to that the exhaustion that comes from activism and all the work that's involved with that, all the social pressure, all the church disciplinary pressure that comes at you, this is something that many people cannot sustain over the long period. So this creates a problem for Mormon feminist movements that need to be long-term, is that many of those original organizers will have moved on. It's just part of the way it goes. There's going to be a lot of turnover, and there's fewer people left to tell you things that they've learned and to pass on that knowledge. All right, 13. However, one thing that I learned as a spokesperson and a board member for Ordained Women is there's actually a lot of support for women's ordination. And you might not hear that support when you're at church, where there's so much pressure to avoid discipline and to save yourself, basically. But when you go out into the community, there are people everywhere who support the ordination of women, and I met them on airplanes, I met them on buses. People were coming out of the woodwork to tell me how much they supported the ordination of women. They weren't necessarily Mormon people, although many of them were. And I think that's another thing to remember, is that throughout the country, throughout other countries, patriarchy is a problem for everyone. And a lot of the problems of patriarchy that we have, not just in churches, but everywhere, is a result of the sexism we learn to tolerate within our places of worship. And so we have allies everywhere who want to make this stop and who are willing to work with us. And we can do more to work with those people. And that's all I have. Thanks.
Gonna go? All right. Okay, yeah, I have like 5 minutes. I promise I'll go fast. I'm sorry, Amy, who's not here, Amy Isaacson Cartwright. She did submit something, and we will post it in the supporters group for people to read. So one of the things that we always hear, that I always get, and it's my favorite question, but it's the hardest to answer, is, why do you want the priesthood? And it's almost always asked by some dude bro online, like on Twitter, some random guy who, it's a no-win question because he doesn't care what the answer is. I always end up getting lectured. I answered that question in March of 2013 when I wrote my profile the night I saw the website and ended it declaring that I'm a Mormon and I believe women should be ordained. Less than 3 weeks later, I stood at a podium just like this at the launch event, and I've been involved with ordained women ever since. When I look back, I realize that I was clearly chosen because I was one of the only Mormon women they could find who was available that night, who had submitted a profile and checked like all the bingo boxes, right? Like I was married in the temple, and I had kids, and I was in the Relief Society presidency, so I was actively attending, and I had a temple recommend, and they were like, whoa. Get her up there. Only three of those things has changed over the last 5 years, and they haven't really changed a lot of through my doing. Like, I did not actively come into this thinking, this would be a great way to get out of my Relief Society calling after my bishop calls me wicked in front of the board. That would be awesome. I didn't go into it hoping that my faith community of women would pull me aside and say their husbands had told them they shouldn't talk to me. And I didn't go into it thinking that I would eventually actually have a panic attack when I put on my garments because my recommend was gone and it was no longer something that felt spiritual but painful. And this is not a sob story, right? Like, with each of those changes, I'm a different person physically. Like, we do family things on Sunday now. We're going kayaking on Sunday if you all want to come with us. And we're together. And I've lost my sleeves, which is liberating when it's 98 degrees outside. And I have some ink and more piercings, and that's fine too. But my relationship to the gospel and my desire for ordination have not changed. I come from a long line of women of faith. My maternal grandmother is an actual daughter of Utah pioneers, literally. She's in the club. And she faithfully attends her LDS ward every week. My paternal grandmother has been a faithful Catholic since she, like, her whole life, and she walked to Mass every week with my grandfather until she couldn't physically go to Mass anymore. And she, like, believes so much that she instructed her daughters to make sure she had a sweater on when she was cremated, because the vault that she and my grandfather were going to be placed in was going to be next to a place that was kind of breezy. And she was like, I'm going to be chilly when Jesus comes back, so please make sure I have a sweater, right? So these are women, this is where I come from, and you don't get to change my relationship to God just because my institutional relationship has shifted slightly. So anyway, my grandfather, also Catholic, they lived in Utah for like 17 years, and he was confused and delighted by Pioneer Day. He thought it was amazing, and he called it Mormon Christmas. And so I'm going to now tell you about an actual Mormon Christmas miracle that I had this year. On July 24th at 12:34 a.m., a dude bro on Twitter asked me, why do you want to be ordained? And I said, okay, here you go. And I gave him 7 tweets, and I'm going to read them to you right now. I've thought and prayed about this since I came to the church at 12 years old. I wanted to faithfully serve and saw young men my age blessing and passing the sacrament, collecting tithes, and serving with home teachers and more. I was not being developed in these ways. As a teen, it bothered me that I needed a blessing, that if I needed a blessing, I had to turn to men in my ward I hardly knew and not the women who had taught me and loved me in Young Women's and brought me to the church with whom I felt comfortable. This changes the feeling of a blessing. As a new wife, I was bothered that when I needed a blessing, my husband could lay his hands on my head, but when he needed one, I had to call on someone outside our home. When I gave birth, he and his father had to try to give me a comforting blessing. They don't get it. I couldn't serve and comfort him in the gospel the way he could me, and I want to be able to do that. As a mother, I was denied the opportunity to participate in any way in my children's blessings, baptisms, confirmations, ordinations. I could not even hold my child nor serve as a witness. I was completely excluded from these moments. When my grandfather died, his daughters, he did not have sons, were not permitted to say the family prayer nor to bless his grave. That had to be done by an in-law whom we loved, but the exclusion of all women in his family was devastating to many of us. I have one son and two daughters. I've run out of any possible explanation for my daughters as to why they should not be considered worthy and useful and responsible in our faith community. I cannot tell them why their brother is actually more than they are. And finally, and most importantly, the priesthood is the power and authority to act in the name of God on the earth. Boys and men are told to desire it and work to be worthy for it. I believe that I can be called to the same desire and worthiness, and I do not apologize for that. Seven tweets. Oh, thank you. Mormon Christmas miracle. Dude bro on Twitter actually said, and I quote, "I don't disagree with those things." And I was like, praise Brigham. I realized the second miracle was that I was sobbing as I finished typing these seven tweets because I actually still want those things, even without the sleeves and even with the tattoos and even with everything that's changed. I swear, right? All of those things, none of that has changed the fact that I still want those things. They're probably not going to happen for me, but I'm here because the future of ordained women, what we're doing now and what we will continue to do locally, is for women of another generation. This is the first time in my life I believe I have actively been fulfilling my temple covenant to build up the kingdom of God on the earth. And I will continue to do that. My 5 years are up. So are my 5 minutes, but I'm just going to end with my 5 years are up. And my time on the board, which has been since that launch event in April, ends on July 31st. I don't really know what I'm going to do with my time, but I do know that I will continue to work for this because I do not apologize for wanting the same things that sons of heavenly parents want. And that's it. Thank you.